Hello and welcome to our second podcast of the Coffee with Clegg podcast series. This one's going to be focused on our endocrine system, which is kind of our initial study for AP2. My name is Professor Clegg, Dr. Clegg, Chelsea Clegg, or if you're a student of mine, you've probably just called me Clegg. And the purpose and intent of this podcast is to give a more on-the-go and more student-centered focus on some of the content topics that we cover in our science classes. Where we start AP1 with this very chemistry-heavy focus, we start AP2 in that same sense. Whether you start with the reproductive system or the endocrine system, we jump right into AP2, picking up with that focus on chemistry. And that can be terrifying for many students. So the intent of this podcast today is going to just be overview of the system, some of the mechanisms of homeostasis that this system utilizes, as well as some of the analogies and current events and ways that the students are engaging with this content. Now, when we think about the endocrine system, we think about a thermostat. That's kind of our go-to when we think about homeostasis. You need something, you respond. You're hot, you sweat, you're cold, you shiver. But it's much more intricate than that, and we deepen our understanding of that. And we also think of the endocrine system a little differently than most of our human body organ systems. We tend to think organ systems are grouped together, right? They need to be in close quarters. The lungs are close to the mouth. The digestive system, the stomach is close to the intestines, but the endocrine system is much more widespread. And we think of it as a communication system that uses that chemistry in order to communicate the hormones. So we tend to group the endocrine and the nervous system together in being our very important communication systems. The two systems work in conjunction with each other. They both work together to help us maintain homeostasis, but the nervous system is fast acting, but short in response duration. So typically it'll work quickly, but it doesn't last a very long time, right? When we need to remove our hand off of a stove, we get that automatic kind of quick reflex action and we remove that hand. It's not something where we're going to keep our hand in the air for hours just because we had that one response. But the endocrine system is much more slow to respond and longer duration. So when we need to regulate those blood sugar levels, when we need to go into a sleep cycle, we want those hormones to have that longer response in our system to last long enough to get those levels back to a resting level. So we typically compare the endocrine system with the autonomic nervous system. They're partly controlled by the hypothalamus. They last a little bit longer, and they work more involuntarily. They're happening right automatically to control many of our vital homeostatic actions. One of the interesting things to consider when thinking about our endocrine system is that it's one of the harder medical professions. It's much more challenging because endocrine disorders are lumped in pretty much all disorders and diseases of our human body systems. And so we tend to find that endocrinologists are a little bit more of a specialty and they take a little bit more referral to get to because it's a very specialized profession. And a totally non-functioning endocrine system is pretty much incompatible with what we consider being alive or life. Most individual endocrine gland disorders have to be treated in order to restore homeostasis, right? If your endocrine system is broken, more than likely you will have some life-threatening homeostatic imbalance. So they have to be treated, regulated medically, surgically. And so in these cases, we tend to see the endocrine system as something of vital importance, right? Loss of homeostasis is loss of life, and the endocrine system is going to be a huge factor in that. Now, it's composed of endocrine glands, as well as certain organs that contain endocrine cells. And that's kind of a new concept. Endocrine glands, that's their job, right? Glandular tissues are secretory. They secrete hormones. Whereas some organs can have specialized cells within them that are able to either receive those hormone responses or create and send out their own hormone action. Thinking back to that idea that we're looking at AP1 and chemistry, we also think back to just what it means to be a cell. That plasma membrane, the cytoplasm, and genetic information that for humans is mostly wrapped in that nucleus. And that phospholipid bilayer of a cell, those floaty, buttery phospholipids, those fats, they have those gates and channels. And it's important to remember that when we talk about the endocrine system and we're looking at receptors on the cell membrane within the cell, right, intracellular, it's all about cascading. It's about some target cells being able to receive amounts of hormones and respond, some being able to create those responses, but the response and action on one target cell can be totally different from another, and that's based on physiological needs, presence of concentrations of chemicals and hormones within the body. But it's just important to think back to that plasma membrane. And for cells on specific organs that are endocrine cells or glandular tissues, they're going to have varying numbers of doors and channels, proteins that bind and change shape to allow the signals of the hormones to react, to bind, to engage, and to start their physiological responses. So again, just trying to break it down in simple terms, all throughout your body and typically controlled by the hypothalamus connected closely with that nervous system, we have hormones that are cascading like a waterfall from head to toe. And those hormones are kind of regulated by our body needs, by the amount of that hormone or chemical present in our body. And it's constantly responding based off of the target cells' receptors and whether they're open or closed, needing to create more space within the cell for those responses to begin. And if you think about that cascade, right, from head to toe, just this flow of chemicals, once those hormones bind to their cells, they're activating another smaller waterfall, either within that cell. Hey, genetically go in there and make more of this protein. Hey, would you stop making this protein? So the cascade effect is body-wide and then within that cell alone. And what we call those technically are mechanisms that control hormone secretion. So how much hormone we're making, what secretion levels we're using are going to be hormonal, humoral, or nervous system. And if we think about that, hormonal is where a hormone from one gland triggers the release of another. So one gland is saying, hey, I need more of the pineal gland release of melatonin, right? We're in a REM cycle. I'm responding. I need more melatonin. And so that response is going to be activated based off of one gland, one hormone triggering the release of another. And yes, melatonin is considered hormonal release and not the best example because typically that's triggered by light dark cycles and increased production during darkness. But it's that idea that the hormone is produced based on that need of the body. If we want a more exact example, one of the more classic examples of hormonal stimulation is thyroid stimulating hormone. So the hypothalamus secretes TRH, which then stimulates the pituitary gland to release thyroid stimulating hormone. So we typically see a lot of that cascade releasing hormones, like thyrotropin releasing hormone, will then trigger thyroid stimulating hormone, which then triggers the thyroid gland to produce the thyroid hormones, T3, all of those other really great thyroid hormones. So we'll see that the presence of that releasing hormone is what activates the cells to start making their other hormones. So releasing hormones, they tickle the stimulating hormones, and then we start actually creating the hormone in response. Humoral stimulation is more of our humors. We used to think of the basic humors of life, right? Like blood. So this mechanism involves changing of blood levels. So a classic example would be parathyroid hormone from that gland and in response to low blood calcium levels. So that's being detected within the blood itself. We're seeing that low blood calcium level, so we're going to release that parathyroid hormone. Nervous system stimulation is typically in response to that fight or flight. It's a nerve impulse that directly tells an endocrine gland, hey, it's time to get moving, right? When we studied the nervous system, we realized that nerves typically tell two main things to do something. Muscles, right? Get up, move, do something, or glands, secrete, activate, engage. So this would be a nervous system stimulation, like the adrenal medulla secreting that epinephrine or norepinephrine in response to fight or flight. Okay, so where we're at. Glandular tissues and glands all throughout the body. Cascading, right? We can think of it as brain all the way to cells throughout our body, or cascading in the sense that it's going from one glandular tissue through the bloodstream directly onto a cell surface and then cascading a response within that cell. And we're also kind of looking at how those responses are maintained. And one of the things to think about is kind of a complicated term, but localized hormones. And depending on who you talk to, it can be a factor in determining whether you call it a local hormone or whether they're paracrine or autocrine, right? Para around, auto automatically, and more within. And typically, you'll hear that some people say that instead of just saying local hormones, you'll have paracrine initiations that are kind of changes within neighboring cells, cells that are grouped together, and you're kind of just trying to activate a response from neighboring cells, or autocrine secretions that will initiate changes in the cell from which it was formed. So the nucleus is cranking out this chemical, this protein that's telling the rest of the cell, okay, this is what we've got to do within our own boundaries. And there's a lot of other factors that go into understanding not just how the hormones talk to each other, but how they move throughout our bodies, because there's so many different ways that chemicals can arrange themselves, right? Proteins are notorious for changing shape. And chemistry is all about shape as well. Is something a spheroid shape? Is it going to be more ring in nature? Is it going to be more linear, right? Are differences between fatty acids, and some of our fats that we studied in our macromolecules. But we tend to see that we have classification in like steroid hormones and lipid soluble hormones, water soluble hormones, just as ways to say how they travel through our body. Do they dissolve well across that phospholipid bilayer, meaning that they can kind of cross that barrier into the cell? Are they more water soluble, which means that they can kind of dissolve themselves and solubilize in the blood? So, you know which word I'm trying to say. They can travel freely within the bloodstream, a much better scientific term. And then some depend on carrier proteins. Maybe they're not a type of hormone that has the capacity for that, but it prolongs the life if we can kind of link it to an Uber driver and let it kind of cart around where it needs to go without being dissociated or dissolved by waters or fats that are present in our body. The bloodstream typically has a greater amount of those lipid soluble hormones bound to a carrier, a bound hormone, but some of it's unbound, depending on the mechanism of that hormone. But when it comes to lipid soluble, again, that means that it can cross those membranes. So we need to make sure that it reaches its target cell. And it's ready typically for the free hormone is more ready for quick action, and it can exit the blood and bind to cellular receptors pretty easily. In a podcast, again, we're trying to bring to light, we're trying to use our words to kind of visualize. So, again, think of these hormones as very oddly shaped, just like humans. There are some short ones, there are some thick ones, there are some thin ones. They have these different arrangements, and depending on those arrangements, it allows them to either travel freely through our more watery-based plasmas and our blood, or they need to bind to an Uber carrier, a walker, a a cane and an Uber driver and allow them to get to their locations a little bit more readily if they're bulkier. But some of those lipid soluble, the minute they get to that plasma membrane, they have a very easy capacity to cross that phospholipid bilayer. Think of it as a jungle, a thick, dense jungle of fats. And because it's lipid soluble, it has the same consistency and it can squeeze through all of those dense forests of trees. And once it does, it typically has a target that it wants to bind to quickly and activate another cascade response and another fast-acting response. Now, there's another couple of concepts when it comes to target cell responses, right? So once the cells, whatever their nature or structure, get to where they're going, right? All cells have the capacity that are endocrine cells to kind of receive those responses. They have those receptors, but how many receptors and whether they're activated or inactive depends on a couple of different natures, right? And we think of concepts when we think of regulating and controlling how much hormone is available and what they do. We think of hormone transport, hormone elimination, the target response, the receptor changes, and the hormone interactions. And so when we think about that, elimination is when we break down the hormones that are there, typically by the liver and the kidneys, and excrete them through our urine and bile, right? It depends a lot on, again, the shape and structure of that hormone and their half-life, the concentration of that hormone's ability to kind of break down within the blood. But once that hormone has done its job, we've kind of mangled it. We need to break it apart and get it out of there because it has served its purpose. You know, once we kind of send that cascade effect, we don't want to just recycle dirty water. We want to create new clean water with new clean hormones. So we need to kind of get what's been utilized out of there. When it comes to target cell response, when a hormone binds to its receptor, it triggers a response, right? And when we think about that lipid bilayer of a cell, once you squeak a lipid-soluble hormone through there, imagine that all of the phospholipids, those dense fatty trees, they have receptors on them that detect, hey, there's something pushing through the trees right now. It's leaving a trail, right? Bigfoot just stomped through our membrane and it's kind of triggering a response. Something is happening. And this is particular even for those that are not lipid soluble that bind to the outside surface of the cell. Once proteins bind, they change shape. Once a receptor is bound to, it either causes something to happen within the cell or it causes changes to the cell membrane's permeability. So anytime that you're touching one of these receptors or moving through these membranes, think about static electricity, just kind of activating some sort of a current. Something is happening that's causing a change. So it triggers some sort of a cellular response. It can cause genes to change. It can cause enzyme activation, cell permeability. Depending on the type and what the mechanism is, there's something happening. Bigfoot trudged through your forest of fats, or someone just got to the trees, couldn't get through, and is asking for permission to come in. And that can cause changes. Cell responses once that has happened. Now, the number of receptors, it fluctuates. Current hormone levels, high hormone levels can lead to down regulation, right? We want to close off those receptors. We want to block the path so that no more activation happens. Low levels can result in upregulation. We increase those receptors, their presence, or how open or available they are, adjusting that cell's sensitivity, right? The more receptors that are present and open, the more available that cell is to that response. And a lot of these reactions, you know, regulation, interaction, they can be synergistic when two hormones are working together. They can be antagonistic when an opposing hormone cuts off the action of another, or pessimistic when one hormone allows another hormone to just come in and exert its full force. So again, when we think about how these cells can acknowledge the hormones, we think about what brought them there, right? You're a cell, you're a glandular tissue or cell, and you're saying, hey, what brought you here? Was it a carrier? Are you coming right in? How am I going to get rid of you when I'm done? Am I going to break you apart? Am I going to eliminate you? How am I going to respond to your presence? Are you here to tell me to calm down? Are you here to tell me to increase my activity and get off my butt? And then one other thing I want to ask, if I'm a cell and this hormone has just showed up, is kind of what changes do I need to make? Are you bringing more friends, right? Am I having a party and I need to open more doors? Do I need more receptors available? Or are you here to tell me to lock up because I need to protect myself? And that's the idea of that concept of responses, target cell and their response to the hormones. Now, we've kind of given an overview, and the next part of your studies would be just to look at every single gland, glandular tissue, look at which hormones they produce, which ones they respond to. And I had a really great question from Molly H, who just talked about a condensed list. And in this case, you really want to use mapping. And there's a concept map that was listed as a challenge for my classes, but you could even do this at home. If you draw an empty human body and place the glands throughout the body, the glandular organs and tissues throughout the body, and then just list out the hormones associated with each, it's a great way to kind of get just a first basic understanding of which hormones are associated with which glands. Now, the next step is to figure out where they connect. And for this, I like to encourage puzzle pieces. There are a lot of really great puzzle templates, and you can print them and fill them in to kind of meet the needs of your understanding, right? This gland secretes this hormone. And if it's a puzzle piece, they would click together. So, in a most simplistic way, I would take four or five puzzle pieces, right, and make a square. One would be a picture of the adrenal medulla, right, the party hat of the adrenal glands. And one puzzle piece would say fight or flight, one would say epinephrine or norepinephrine. I could then make a completely separate puzzle and put a picture of the pancreas on one square. I would put control blood sugar, right, as one of the squares that goes with that, and insulin and glucagon on another square. So, in your mind, I want you to picture four separate puzzles, and each one is being put together for that particular gland, right? The ovaries, I would have a picture of the female reproductive tract on one. I would have estrogen and progesterone. And then maybe one puzzle piece would say menstrual cycle, so that you can kind of group together and see based on which gland. So it helps to kind of think of those puzzle pieces and put them all together, and then you can deepen that a little bit further, right? Is the epinephrine or the norepinephrine coming from the adrenal medulla, the adrenal cortex? Keep expanding it once you get that very basic puzzle piece in your mind. Another really great kind of analogy that my students came up with this semester was Olivia C., who, instead of using this idea of a thermostat, she looked at a washing machine and kind of the smart cycles of your washing machine. And you can think about that in the endocrine system as well, where if you have a smaller load, your cycle would run less detergent, less fabric softener, and it would be a shorter cycle. And those hormones would be associated specifically with that cycle. But the brain, right, the lead, the master endocrine gland, the nervous system helper, the hypothalamus, that's telling, it's detecting which size load based off of what's present already in that washing machine. You also can think of the washing machine like a bleach cycle. There's only whites. I only need bleach in this one particular circumstance. So I need to add the bleach, right, in order to get the appropriate effect. It's not already present in the system. We're introducing it. So there's a lot of ways that you can take the idea of a washing machine and just write it out right now on a sheet of paper. Washing machine acts like the endocrine system, and see how many connections you can make to how it functions. But it's this idea that it's a constant change and shift based off of the needs of that load of clothes. What's present? What's active? What can that machine do to help maintain the goal, which is cleanliness or homeostasis in this point? Now, I did have a really great research connection this time, and you can connect anything to the endocrine system, but I had a student, Hannah D, who talked a little bit about hormonal birth control and venous thrombosis. And birth control is a huge push when we think about the endocrine system and understanding better the impact on our bodies. And this will also be huge as we get into the idea of gender assignment and changes that we're making chemically to our genders. But when we put this hormonal birth control in our body, we have the potential to change other hormone responses. And there have been some studies out that certain proteins promote blood clotting throughout the body, and hormonal birth control pills can contain some of the hormones that trigger that production of protein. Again, these studies, you have to, take them with a grain of salt because you want to make sure that they're very scientific in nature. And in this case, she was talking about coagulation effects of oral contraception, which was published in the scientific database. So we look at these studies and we look at, okay, what demographic of person were you studying? How long was your study? Were there any variables that couldn't be accounted for? But we take what we saw, which was a trend, and we try to make it make sense. How can we use hormonal birth control in a safer way for those who may be at risk for some of these clots? So there's a lot of great research out there that talks about how these hormones can affect some of the proteins that are produced in other cells and locations in the body, and how we can, in this case, eliminate them so they don't cause those changes. We also had a really great question from Ashley W., specifically eicosanoids and prostaglandins. And in studying, again, we're kind of just giving a broad overview. It's kind of on the students to start learning some of those major hormones and their actions. But when we think of eicosanoids, one of the things that can be really confusing is understanding how it's different than the prostanoids or prostaglandins. And the idea is that eicosanoids are classified into two groups, like leukotrienes and prostanoids. And prostanoids are then further divided into like the prostaglandins and the thromboxes, and we'll see a lot of different classifications. But when we think about eicosanoids, they're not necessarily stored within cells, but they're synthesized as required. They are derived from fatty acids, particularly like the ones that make up cell membranes and the nuclear membranes. And they begin synthesis. They're created and activated by like a mechanical trauma, cytokines, growth factors, other stimuli. And this triggers the release of the phospholipase at the membrane. And that's when we start to kind of develop these eicosanoids. And again, eicosanoid, the term itself is 20. It's Greek for 20. So it's a 20-carbon fatty acid, just to tell you that that's the structure that it is created from. So that's where we get that name. It's a large family of a 20-carbon atom. And most of these are potent, not protein, looking at my notes here, potent lipid mediators. So again, they're made of that fatty substance, and they're a fatty acid substance. And that means that they have a very powerful ability to kind of process and respond to inflammation, cardiovascular function, tumor progression. And examples of them are prostaglandins. Eicosanoids are interesting because they're not necessarily like our typical hormones that are created by a gland and then secreted somewhere, right? It's not being created by the thyroid and then shipped to a cell or any of those. It's more of a local hormone. And remember, earlier in the podcast, we talked about what it means to be local. And in this case, it's created directly by the tissue. And all cells have this arachidonic acid. It's part of kind of
Acid.
the arachidonic acid, and it's part of these plasma membranes. And so most all of these cells that have these plasma membranes have this arachidonic acid in it, and so they then have the ability to make eicosanoids. It's what kind of gives the foundation. What's interesting about eicosanoids is a lot of their functionality. So when we think about them as not necessarily a hormone class, but a type of chemical response, depending on where they're created, which tissues they're created from, it can change the effect that it has in the body. So, for example, if the prostaglandins, right, that subcategory of eicosanoids are created from the hypothalamus, they may respond more to fever. But if they're created from the stomach tissues, they would be more involved in mucus production and protection of the stomach from acidic acids. So, depending on the location of their creation, can change what they do for our bodies, which is hugely important. Instead of a gland that secretes this one primary hormone over and over, they have the ability to be very diverse in their use based off of where they're created. The endocrine system could be days-long conversations. And again, this was just a recap of some of the major highlights of the system where we look a little bit less at the memorization aspects. We do talk about that tool and using puzzles as a way to learn the major hormones and their purpose, as well as concept maps. But the main focus is just talking about how those hormones go through the body, some of the major functions of those hormones in terms of their cellular engagement. How do we cut the cells on? How do we activate them? And we're simply cascading from primary cells to secondary cells, from targets to receptors. And we're looking at how they kind of poke the cells to either providing them what they need or activating that cell to have some sort of a response. The endocrine system is all about communication through chemicals, and we want them to last a little longer, but we still need to remove them as necessary. I hope this has helped, and I appreciate the student insights and kind of suggestions that were given. And in our next podcast, we'll dig a little deeper on some of those specific hormone functions.